Welcome to Season 8 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage approximately $100 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and retail investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest is a legendary architect and urban planner, perhaps best known for her work on the remarkable Oriel Park at Camden Yards, which set the standard for sports architecture when it opened in 1992. She grew up in Mississippi and got degrees in architecture and urban planning from Mississippi State and City College of New York. Through her remarkable career, she has worked for the Baltimore Orioles, Turner Sports, owner of the Braves and the Hawks, the Boston Red Sox, and most recently the Los Angeles Dodgers, in a variety of roles around planning and development of stadiums in their surrounding areas. Beyond baseball, she's been involved in urban planning work like Battery Park City in New York and projects as far afield as Stamford Bridge, home of Chelsea Football Club in London. Just last year, she founded Elysian Park Planning, an independent design firm focused on venue and development projects across the globe. So without any further ado, I am honored to welcome in this week's HPS Cast guest, Janet Marie Smith, legend in the sports architect and urban planning world. Janet, welcome to the pod.
Thank you.
Well, Janet, I like to go all the way back to start. Where are you from originally? Where'd you grow up?
Jackson, Mississippi.
All right. So you grew up in Jackson, you attend Mississippi State and get a degree in architecture. It's obviously your life's passion, your work. How did you come to that? Why was architecture the right path for you?
Well, my dad was an architect, so I was exposed to it at an early age. And the School of Architecture was new at the time in Mississippi, and there was an energy about it that was really appealing to me. I can't say, to be honest, that I really thought my calling was architecture per se. I just thought it was sort of a great combination of engineering, art, and I love cities. So this was a chance to have an influence, I hoped, on the way cities would grow.
Speaking of cities, you then moved to the City College of New York for your urban planning degree. Why was that? What was the appeal of a master's to augment your educational experience there?
Well, I actually moved to New York first just because I was dying to go to New York. And once I got there, I got the job with the Battery Park City Authority overseeing the development of the Lower Manhattan MOM. And that was just an amazing education. And after I'd been there a few years, I felt a need to maybe organize some of my experiences intellectually. And I found this program at City College, now City University of New York. You went to school from, you know, 4 in the afternoon through the evenings to study law, real estate, all the things that sort of supplement urban planning.
So tell me about that first job at Battery Park City. I always say first jobs are formative. What do you hold on from that experience in your early career?
Well, absolutely. And Battery Park City for decades had been thought of as a new community. There were scheme after scheme of towers and big plazas, or the not unlike what was built in Albany, because that was what urban planning was doing at the time. But it never got off the ground. It was just too big. Developers were not building 2,000 units of housing at a time. And by the 70s, when New York was in a rut, they weren't building anything. And as planners like to say, that is the best time to plan. And the profession that we call urban design actually came out of city planning in the late 70s and early 80s. And by the time I moved to New York, there was a total rethink about Battery Park City. And the planning firm that we had hired to do this had focused on the traditional aspects of New York classic buildings of a, you know, coming down to the sidewalk, having retail on the sidewalk. You know, there was a rhythm to New York, and we were trying to replicate that. So fast forward however many years, when I came to Baltimore to work on Oriel Park at Camden Yards, my experience in working with an urban design firm that had taught me how to look at cities and how to interpret them so that it could carry into new buildings was very much a part of the tools that I brought to that job.
Battery Park does feel very much of New York, per your point, in a way that Camden Yards is certainly of Baltimore. Well, let's get there. So it's 1989. You get the opportunity to move down as their VP of Planning and Development. Let's start with, how did that job come about?
When I was in school in New York, we studied cities as a part of our urban planning program. And Baltimore had been held out as a city that had successfully transformed its industrial heart into something new when industry left. So Baltimore had reinvented itself, and that's what we studied. They built a convention center, an aquarium, a science center, a waterfront promenade.
the Inner Harbor's fantastic in a way that it wasn't, you know, 50 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's all these things that we think of today, the Urban Land Institute would refer to it as an urban entertainment center. Baltimore was just trying to stay alive, you know, keep its head above water. And they had a mayor who became governor who just cared passionately about the city and directed a lot of state money there. And when I first learned that the Orioles were going to be building a new ballpark in downtown Baltimore, I thought, oh, shucks, you know, I kind of like Memorial Stadium. It's this great old shoe ballpark, home of the Colts, home of the Orioles, seen some World Series. It just seemed like
it had real history. Yeah.
Yeah, right. It had real personality. But then I had this eureka moment and I thought, there goes Baltimore doing it again, dropping 3 million fans a year into the center city to populate the hotels, the restaurants. That is such a smart move.
The rest is history, by the way, dear listener, as we'll find out. So let's give some context. Janet, we have listeners from around the globe. Camden Yards opened in 1992. As you say, they decided to upgrade from the old Memorial Stadium. It truly kicked off an era of innovative downtown park designs, like integrating a field and an arena in a city that now feels sort of standard was truly groundbreaking at the time. How did that all come together?
Well, the stars were really aligned by two acts of two different men who probably did not realize at the time how important their individual goals were to the success of the others. William Donald Schaefer, who had been the mayor of Baltimore, had been elected governor. He had seen the Baltimore Colts, the football team, literally pack up and leave in the middle of the night and move to another city. Somewhat unprecedented, unusual in America sports, even today. But he knew that this was real, that the Orioles were not going to stay in an inferior building. Much as we might have loved Memorial Stadium sentimentally, they were not going to stay there. It was on his watch that all of the aforementioned improvements had been done in downtown Baltimore. And so he really felt strongly that any new stadium should be downtown. He had invested heavily on transit. Baltimore had trains that went to Washington, had light rail that was under construction, had then and has today a very strong presence on Amtrak. And he's thought, why would we want to go build anywhere but where we already have this infrastructure? Larry Lucchino, who became president of the Baltimore Orioles, he cared only about building an old-fashioned ballpark with modern amenities that had the charm of the early ballparks, such as Forbes Field, where he had grown up in Pittsburgh, Wrigley Field, Fenway Park, Ebbets Field. And had we been downtown and Larry not cared so much about this ballpark thing, we might have had just another round donut.
Well, you mentioned Fenway. You then moved to Boston with the Red Sox. What were you doing as part of the initiative for them?
Well, Larry Lucchino of Baltimore Orioles fame had by then, exactly 10 years after Camden Yards opened, become the president and CEO of the Boston Red Sox. And significantly, when the team was sold, they were the only group that proposed to save Fenway Park. By then, Fenway, having opened in 1912, was the oldest operating ballpark in America. And for decades, the Boston Red Sox had presumed that it was going to have to be torn down, that it was too small, too old, too fragile, too this, too that. Like, there just wasn't any way it was going to be saved.
As a lifelong Red Sox fan with a preservationist streak, I mean, that's just horrifying to hear, but I understand how people would have come there.
Well, I often say, in many ways, time was on the side of Fenway, because certainly a park that has, you know, less than 35,000 seats in an era when the norm was 55,000, seemed impossible to expand. By the time Larry Lucchino, John Henry, and Tom Werner bought the club in 2002, the norm had dropped to around 40,000. So suddenly we didn't look quite so small. I mean, I'd love to paint ourselves as geniuses, but the truth of the matter is the trends had changed and it was easier to think about modernizing this. So we brought an architectural firm and who I knew had really strong preservationist and urban sensibilities to help us think through how can we look at this ballpark and what could we do to give it longevity and to preserve the oldest park in the major leagues.
Amazing. When you think about that responsibility, you know, and there are modern needs. I mean, I've been to countless games at Fenway, and I remember in the old days, you know, your knees are running into the seat in front of you. You're sitting in a seat. You're kind of staring out at outfield. But how do you balance those trends, the sort of the modern needs and what people expect with still retaining what is ultimately a cathedral, right, of the sport?
Well, one of the benefits of working in 5-month increments is you can't mess up too many things. And so I actually think that the phased approach really helped us, as did just our respect for the building. We had a few tricks in our pocket. There were two buildings adjacent Fenway Park that the team had purchased decades earlier. And we went to the Zoning Board of Appeals and asked if we could append those buildings to Fenway Park and knock out the walls in between so that we essentially, without changing a brick, expanded our footprint by growing into those buildings and did some really novel things like put turnstiles on the city street so that we were able to have additional square footage. We worked with the city of Boston to lease the air rights over Lansdowne Street to create what's called the Green Monster seats, still some of the most popular seats in all of baseball.
They're unbelievable having watched a game from there. And it's one of those aha moments where you're like, how in the world did it take them till whatever it was, 02, 03, I guess, probably to put those in, right? It's amazing what you guys did.
Well, what was amazing about it was not just replacing the net that used to catch home run balls with seats, but the fact that we recommended only putting less than 500 seats there. Now, remember, Fenway's challenge for decades had been it's too small. So if we'd really been packing them in and putting in thousands of seats, we might have achieved the capacity goal quicker. But our thesis was, if you make them rare and you make them special, they'll always have a cachet.
All right. So Janet, success to success, you then move on to LA and become SVP and eventually EVP of planning and development for the LA Dodgers. Now, Dodger Stadium, we've talked about your preservation streak. You know, 62 was built, third oldest ballpark in America. It's iconic. But what excited you about that opportunity? When they came calling, what was the pitch that reeled you in?
Well, it was, as you say, the third oldest park in the major leagues. And I had lived less than 2 miles from Dodger Stadium. And I just loved it. I could just sort of pull in and grab a ticket and enjoy a few innings. It was the era of Fernando Mania and Tommy Lasorda's teams. It was just a fantastic experience. And one thing that I really loved about that was that Los Angeles at the time did not have a lot of public places, and Dodger Stadium was a very public place. And so the kind of energy that I'd grown accustomed to feeding off of in New York, I could find at the baseball park.
You've been at the Dodgers for over a decade now, so clearly their projects have retained your interest. Tell me about some of the most recent efforts and what you've been spending your time on. What are the work streams that are getting you excited?
Well, the one that we just finished, which was the new front door to Dodger Stadium, as a means of adding space to a building that rises from one level 110 feet up to the top deck. One of our challenges was how to connect all of these different parts of Dodger Stadium to each other and have a central place. And over the 10 years that I've been there, as a part of the renovations, we've expanded the footprint to create a plaza at each of the 13 entrances. The last to be done was the center field plaza. We decided to do this project knowing that we were going to be able to host the All-Star Game in 2020. So we worked for several years to get the plans right. We had all of our permitting lined up. It was a $100 million project. And we all know what happened to the baseball season in 2020.
Life comes at you fast, Janet.
It sure did. But when we finally did get to open at full capacity mid-season 2021, you felt that people were so eager to be back together. And I have just loved Dodger Stadium, Dodger fans, the enthusiasm of Los Angeles, the multicultural sector of Los Angeles that's expressed at Dodger Stadium, and how important that is, I think, for all of sports to be able to demonstrate what it's like to all be together, sort of rooting for the same thing.
I love it. I love it. All right. My last question for you, Janet, then, if I rule out your prior employers, because I think that's unfair, or projects that you specifically worked on, what is your favorite ballpark to watch a baseball game in and why?
Wow. Let's see. Well, I love the scale of minor league ballparks. I love the scale of some of the really historic older parks. And the few times I've had a chance to work on something that's, you know, 5,000 to 15,000 seats has just been delicious. You know, it's just so much you can do with that. And I love the little historic ballpark in Birmingham, Alabama, known as Rickwood Field. It's got the craziest light towers I've ever seen. And I think it's just such a treasure to see that that community, even as they've invested in a new minor league ballpark, have worked so hard to keep that building alive.
That's fantastic. Janet, thank you so much for your thoughts. Just fascinating stuff. With that, I want to move to the last segment of the podcast, which is something we like to call Best Ideas. It's where we offer up something that's added value in our lives recently called Best Ideas, because it's our goal as investors to maximize exposure to those. Janet, you're our guest. I'm going to ask you to go first. What is your best idea this week?
Well, I don't know if it's my best idea, but it's a reoccurring thing for me. I think the best ideas don't come from looking in the rearview mirror at what you've done in the past, but by looking ahead or to the side and figuring out how something can apply to your world that's not really of your world. And I think that much of the reason that the sports projects that we've talked about have been so well received by fans is that they don't represent the formula that's traditionally associated with the sports venue. So I often tell my team, you know, sometimes I might go in on a Sunday afternoon because I'm old, but I tell them, please don't. Like, go to a car show, go to the beach, go to a beer garden, go to a museum. What are people doing with their leisure time? What's out there? How do we bring those kinds of environments into buildings so that as we think about not just sports, but theater, museums, public parks, you know, how are we spending our non-working hours? And it's not a new idea, but it's something I've always felt was really important.
But I think it's a great idea. I mean, I always say you can't do our job from our desks, you know, like you need to be out there. It's part of it. And as you said, when you're bringing in all these disparate, you know, constituents and different aspects of these ballparks, you have to have, you know, be living your life to understand how people would use it. I think that's a fantastic idea. All right. Well, Janet, for my best idea, people know I like to be inspired by the guests of the week. And as we've talked about, Janet has made a career around the sport of baseball. And as listeners have heard from me previously, I have a teenage son who plays travel baseball, and he deeply loves the New York Mets. He's a huge baseball fan. So I went non-traditional. I actually outsourced my best idea to him this week. I asked him for his favorite piece of media about baseball. Interestingly enough, his first idea has already been a best idea. He offered up the book Moneyball, which I've recommended before, but his second was perfect. And so my, or maybe I should say his, best idea this week is the incredible four-part documentary about the 86 World Series winning Mets, ESPN's Once Upon a Time in Queens. The doc does a remarkable job of capturing the 86 Mets, a team full of complete characters, but also situating it in 1980s go-go New York. Like, this is very much Bonfire of the Vanities era on Wall Street and the city. It pulls no punches. It shines light on a team that had many players battling some real addiction issues. But it also captures a dominating year on the field by one of the best baseball teams of all time. Like, the 86 Mets are one of just three National League teams to win twice as many games as they lost in the regular season. It's thrilling. It's wonderfully produced. It's a riveting watch, whether or not, you know, you're a big baseball fan. So in honor of my guest, one of baseball's luminaries, let me recommend the incredible documentary Once Upon a Time in Queens, streaming on ESPN. Janet, have you ever watched that one?
I have not, but please tell your son. It's on my list now.
You got to check it out, especially for somebody who appreciates the city like you do. It's just an amazing documentary. Well, with that, Janet, it's time to wrap up for the week. A true pleasure hearing all you've been up to. Good luck on all the great projects to come, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
Thanks again to our guest, Janet Marie Smith. Check out our show notes to learn more about Janet and her role with the Los Angeles Dodgers. You'll also find links to my son's best idea of the week, the ESPN documentary Once Upon a Time in Queens. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.